here's what I'm annoyed about. I go to this Toyota dealership because when we bought our car, there was like X amount of service that goes along with it. And then the force of habit that they have when you're like, oh, okay, well, there's a sticker in my window. I'll call the number on the sticker. When it hits the number, I go there and I get the service. Last time it cost a little bit of money. This time the guy says, hey, $35. We're going to rotate your tires. We're going to check your fluids and you should be in and out of here in an hour and a half. Hour and a half is fine. All right. It's a little bit longer than I would want for them to rotate my tires and check my fluids, but it is what it is. I'll sit there and drink their stupid pod coffee and listen to other people watch Price is Right while I wait for my car. So then it starts getting closer and closer to when we have to do Where Not Wrong. And I start looking around and I start walking up and down the service area because I got all these little pods and the dude who took my car is sitting in another office and we make eye contact. Now he knows that he took my keys, at least as much he can recognize me as much as I can recognize him, which is barely. I walk up and down and just try to make myself a nuisance and finally just go over to somebody else. And I say, hey, I just need to know how long my car is going to take. So they call the dude. The dude comes out of his meeting and there on his desk are my keys. And I don't know how long my keys have been there. I don't know if those keys have been there for an hour. I don't know if they just got there 5 minutes ago. But it's frustrating because I got other shit to do. The motherfucker told me an hour and a half. It's now 2 hours and 15 minutes. So he shows up and he's like, oh, yeah. Picks up my keys that have been on his desk, starts doing the thing. And then he's got the unmitigated gall to try and sell me on a tire rotation package because he would like for me to pay $230 right now instead of the $35 that I owe him so I can keep coming back for this service for the next five tire rotations. At which point in the middle of it, I cut him off like a Jehovah's Witness at the front door. And I was like, look, I don't need it. I just need to pay for this. I got other shit I need to do. And he stops me. And goes, no, you don't understand the savings. And it completes his little sermon. I get there and I get out of there. I get my keys. I leave. I've never been more frustrated about an automotive experience than what I just experienced right now. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
But it was meant to be, because if you were on time, we wouldn't have gotten the news. We would have been completely out of date on our first story. So it was
we're still going to be out of date on our first story because who knows where it's going to be by the time that we're done recording. So it's still, we didn't even fix it with Hunter Biden. Not even Hunter Biden can make me happy.
See the goddamn bright side, Justin Robert Young.
No, I'm done. I've lanced the boil. The poison has been expunged and now we are ready. We're ready to go. Anyway, Heaton, how are you?
I'm good. My most salient car dealership thing, I won't do all my complaining, but I do remember when I was buying my last car that I went to different car dealerships and looked at the cars and got on this one and the guy like explained the benefits of the car and stuff. And I was like, oh, it sounds pretty good. I'll probably come back here in a couple of days. And if it's still around and I decide to get it, then we'll do it then. And he looked at me and said with the most like mic dropping, I fucking got you attitude. He goes, well, tell me this, why not buy it tonight? And I went, because I'm going to compare it to the other vehicles I'm looking at in terms of cost, gas mileage, and so forth. And it's a very expensive purchase that I shouldn't make on impulse. I should think about it. And he went, oh. And I was like, what? Like, why did you think your comment was good? That was the thing that baffled me. It was a really stupid thing to say, but he said it like it was brilliant. I've never understood it.
Oh, that's because you have low T. Like that's it. He was challenging your manhood to be like, hey, if you were a real man, then you would just know it when you see it, brother. And you would just buy it because what's a sense of wasting time? You might as well just buy this car. And then you were like, wait, no, I have reasons for doing it my own way. To which he said, damn, my gendered sales tactic was foiled. I guess I'll just go leave.
So if I now I'm sold. So if I go back to that car dealership in Tulsa and I buy that car from him, I will be more manly.
No, because you waited.
Damn it. Okay.
You are already a beta
back to sucking soy and masturbating in seclusion. That's as it. I usually do as a beta male in my time of my life.
Sounds like the moral to these stories is fuck cars, take the bus.
Exactly. Sure. There we go. Heaton will just get back to his 8,000 word glowing review of Barbie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I watched Oppenheimer.
You did?
I haven't seen the Barbie one.
I saw both of them back to back.
Should I see him?
I saw both of them.
Oh, that's right. How was Barbie?
I'm going to say I'm not the target demo.
Would it be the thousands of women I've seen streaming to and fro the theater wearing pink? Would that be the target demo?
I would say that it is a movie made for them in a way that there are other movies made for me. And I don't necessarily even mean on gender. I mean, in terms of sociopolitical commentary and direct fan call outs to different Barbie outfits. So like if there were a IP that I was extraordinarily tied to through my youth and had this effect on our larger dialogue, then I would probably appreciate it on a level that women who played with Barbies and have gone to Sarah Lawrence College and thought about what Barbie means to feminism of love Barbie. I mean, it is a bit of an essay in the Jezebel comments, but I don't know. I thought there's really, really funny parts to it. And Ryan Gosling is both of them, Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling, are like perfectly cast in it.
Well, Margot Robbie's fantastic. And while it doesn't sound like it's for me, I wish the greatest of joy to anybody that can snatch happiness from the jaws of the miserable existence we find ourselves in. Yeah. So if anybody likes Barbie, good for them. Yeah. I'm not going to militate against it. My immediate follow-up is, if I wait outside the theater, are the gals going to be more feisty and empowered? Like, should I just stand there waiting for them to come talk to me? Or is this even worth attempting? Should I just go?
I think you should stay as far away as possible. You should steer clear. I think everybody should see it if you want to. It is a well-made movie. Greta Gerwig's a great writer and a great director. It was a little odd that she put a lot of like slapsticky kind of like almost vaudeville comedy, especially in the first act. But other than that, I will say that it is far more relevant to my own life story, to watch Oppenheimer, a film in which he says his catchphrase while reading Sanskrit and nutting into Florence Pugh.
Ew.
That is an actual scene that happens. His catchphrase is said for the first time in the movie while he is having sex with a bare-chested Florence Pugh. That is what we like to call in the industry boy shit. There's a lot of girl shit that happens in Barbie. There's a lot of boy shit that happens in Oppenheimer. It was a fascinating trip between the poles of our battles of the sexes in one afternoon at the cinema.
I'm going to say something controversial. I neither liked nor hated Oppenheimer. I was kind of 3 stars on it, 3 out of 5. I didn't think it was horrible. I frankly think it's overhyped. It was an enjoyable film, but the first half of it was can the plucky scientists come together to do the thing? And then they do it. And I'm like, oh, good. The film is over. And they're like, oh, no. Now it's a court trial film. Want to watch this business? And I was like, I would have been fine with either of these. I don't really like them in conjunction with one another. So it was okay.
Well, that is the classic Nolan move, is that when the movie's done, nope, I have another hour for you. And sometimes it gets super weird and Matthew McConaughey's in a space closet. And sometimes it's Batman where you have another Joker scene when you just had one of the greatest chase scenes of all time. And that could have ended the movie. In this one, I actually liked it mostly. Well, I will say I liked Oppenheimer a lot because it was a Christopher Nolan movie that I don't have to lie to all my friends and say that I totally understood without reading the Wikipedia. And that has not been the case for many Christopher Nolan movies. This one had one weird convention and you find out what it is pretty clearly in the third act. And then a bunch of character actors do some character actory shit. I loved it. Austin, Texas. I'm an extraordinarily hyped up Justin Robert Young from Mexico City, Mexico.
I am a Jennifer Briney that ate between 15 and 20 mini meatballs for breakfast, and I am extraordinarily low.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland.
I'm Andrew Heaton, and I've carbo-loaded, but am low testosterone, so meeting you all in the middle.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we will talk about the latest news we can on Hunter Biden, because we assumed that things would be more final by the time that we began recording, as well as a union push to purchase a folding beer brand in San Francisco. That, along with your emails. Jen, how much time do you have left in Mexico?
2 weeks and one day.
2 weeks and one day. And where are you headed after that?
Oh my God. So many places. Bay Area for a wedding, Los Angeles, Denver, Park City, Butte, Montana, Flathead Lake. And then eventually we'll come back to Austin.
Damn.
So it'll be a lot.
That is a family circus looping throughout the American West before you come back down south to Texas. And Heaton, Edinburgh treating you good?
Yeah, it's nice. It's like, I don't know, 55 degrees out. I'm catching up with friends, hanging out, all that stuff. It sounds a lot less breakneck paced than our friend Briney, but it's very nice.
There we go. You know, catch up. It's the small pleasures in life that really matter.
Justin, do you have any adventures planned before we're all reunited?
Yeah, I'm going to Las Vegas in 2 weeks for DEF CON.
What is that?
That is the hacker convention that comes to Las Vegas yearly. And I'm very excited because I definitely want to make time to go out and see what they call Democracy Village. Now, this is something that has since taken on a more political context, but has happened for many, many years. DEF CON is a celebration of all things hacking. They hack everything from cars to Internet of Things devices. You have a lot of people that demonstrate.
Voting machines.
And Democracy Village is exactly that, is the hacking of voting machines. So I very much would like to see the latest on that. I think that it is something for which everybody should be up on, but it is something that in a bygone era, you had a lot of Democrats talking about how voting machines can be hacked. Now you have a lot of Republicans that are talking about how voting machines can be hacked, and on and on and on. We'll keep forgetting that the other one said it first until we say it now. And you know, the Aurora Bow of this argument will continue to go. But I want to see it, and I've been going to DEF CON for the last few years because our friend Darren Kitchen and Hack 5.
Shout out to Darren Kitchen.
Yeah, they are like the Walmart of pen testing devices. So I go and help him out with his booth. Anyway.
Oh, how fun.
Darren, by the way, is one of those guys that, like, I'll get in conversation with people and they're like, you should interview this guy, Darren Kitchen. And I'm like, I had drinks with him last night. Like, we're Darren and I are buddies. Like, that Darren Kitchen?
Yeah, no, it's it is always a good time because he's like the Beatles there. Like, and he listens to this show. So now he's embarrassed and he's going to text me and say, oh my God, I was embarrassed that you were talking about that.
Hi, Darren. We miss you.
Yeah, him and his girlfriend, Eva, they love the show.
Wife.
And his other girlfriend, Mitchell.
Oh, geez, you just causing trouble.
You know
what?
That started out being a good joke, and then I messed up the name. There's no other girlfriend. Let's move on.
I love Eva.
Speaking of other women, let's talk about Hunter Biden. During public congressional testimony last week, a peer of Internal Revenue Service whistleblowers said that throughout their investigation into Hunter Biden, decisions were made that benefited the president's son from above the chain of command. The two IRS whistleblowers are Gary Shapley, a supervisory special agent, and Joseph Ziegler, a criminal investigator. Shapley has worked for the IRS for 14 years, serves as the team leader in the agency's International Tax Fraud and Financial Crimes Group, which oversaw the IRS investigation into Hunter Biden. And Ziegler, whose identity was concealed until he publicly testified at the House Oversight Committee, has worked in the IRS Criminal Investigation Division for 13 years. In November of 2018, he initiated the inquiry into Hunter Biden's tax filings. The two whistleblowers accuse the Delaware Assistant U.S. Attorney Leslie Wolf, an assistant to U.S. Attorney for Delaware David Weiss, of repeatedly blocking further investigation into Hunter Biden. They say she denied a request for a search warrant of Joe Biden's Wilmington home, where Hunter kept some of his financial records, citing optics. They say she also prevented investigators from asking about Joe Biden's connection to his son's finances and denied a request to interview Mr. Biden's adult grandchildren about their connections to deductions claimed on Hunter Biden's tax returns. She informed Mr. Biden's lawyers that investigators were interested in documents contained in a rented Northern Virginia storage unit, allowing the Bidens to access the unit before investigators could take action. Quote, Ziegler, I have reason to believe that there was gross mismanagement present throughout the investigation, and there was a gross waste of funds related to the tax dollars spent on investigating this case, that there was an abuse of authority. Shapley says that the IRS had largely concluded its investigation by the end of 2021 and had decided that Hunter Biden be charged with multiple tax fraud felonies. The agency officially referred to those conclusions to U.S. government attorneys in Washington, D.C. in February of 2022 and in California in September of 2022, yet neither took action. In an October 7, 2022 meeting, Shapley described how Mr. Weiss, who is theoretically the head of this and is a Trump-appointed U.S. attorney, told a group of senior IRS and FBI officials that he, quote, was not the deciding person on whether charges are filed, end quote. Shapley documented that meeting, which he attended, in an email later that day to an IRS colleague. That was my red line, Shapley said during the testimony. The Justice Department allowed the president's political appointees to weigh in on whether or not to charge the president's son. Weiss has said that he did have full authority to charge, and the lesser penalties that eventually came down in a plea deal, which we will get to in a second, were his decision. Attorney General Merrick Garland has said the same thing. Weiss said the following month that the statute of limit, Shapley said the following month that the statute of limitations had been allowed to lapse on Hunter Biden's 2014 and 2015 tax returns, even though prosecutors had sought an extension. Ultimately, Mr. Weiss did bring charges against Mr. Biden as part of a plea deal, but for misdemeanors that carry no prison time, not the felonies that the IRS investigators had recommended. Add to that a news story by Insider revealing that one of the people who purchased Hunter Biden's artwork, which is now how he is making a living, was somebody who has been named to the Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad by Joe Biden's White House. We do not know when those items happened, when the purchase was made versus when the appointment was made, but Insider believes that it is the same person. In leaked messages from Hunter Biden's laptop previous to all this, he had bragged about getting another family friend appointed to the same position during the Obama administration. And more, the Hunter Biden plea deal, at least as we record right now, appears to be modified from what was initially put forward, as lawyers and the judge are arguing about a portion of that deal that would prevent further prosecution into Hunter Biden. Jen, you have been paying closer attention to this breaking news as I have been frustrated by getting back to my house from South Austin, Toyota. What is the state of play from what you have been able to follow?
So what I was gathering from CNN, keeping in mind that like the details are fuzzy, as we started recording here, they had just finished the hearing. But from what I understand, because they did take a recess and reporters were able to come out and tell what they were hearing, the big news appears to be that there is an ongoing investigation into possible violations of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, as in Hunter Biden's doing foreign agent type shit.
Yeah.
And so they just wanted to be really careful to make sure that the plea deal didn't in any way give him immunity for anything that could be related to that. And then there was something about the gun charge too, but really this like FARA investigation, that's what we didn't seem to know was happening. Like there was an idea that this plea deal would just make all of Hunter's problems go away. Apparently that is not the case, but before we went on the air, there is some kind of plea deal. So it looks like the tax related stuff is will be going pled to be over.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. By the end of the day. That's what we know.
Please do not take our conversation that we are about to have as being fully read in on how this ends, because we don't know how it ends, because we're talking about it while it is happening. And so the question, does any of this rise to a level of suspicion that touches President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. Heaton?
Yeah, this smells fishy to me. I think I'm going to reverse course. We discussed this, the tax deal, maybe 2 months ago. And at the time, I thought this was something that the Republicans were being partisan on, and it didn't rise to the level of scrutiny. My reasoning at the time was that, as I understand it, if you are delinquent in payments to the IRS, but you do pay them back, even if they're delinquent along with a fine, they're not going to prosecute you, and that's standard. And that... typically with a gun violation as he had, although there are examples that are counter to it, typically speaking, a prosecutor is not going to pursue a felony charge on that. Having now watched the whistleblower testimony from both Shapley and Ziegler, there's a lot of stuff there that gives me serious pause. And I am forced to just once again reconsider how would I be looking at the situation if the exact same things were occurring with President Trump and Donald Trump Jr. And my suspicion is that I would be talking about how corrupt the Trump White House is, and how there was a dereliction of duty in regards to the machinations of the state and the family involved and so on and so forth. It seems to me that there's a lot of stuff going on there. The charges that are being brought by the whistleblowers is serious. They did speak in enough organizational jargon that I'm not able to follow all of it. I don't know the ins and outs of their testimony, but one thing that did stand out to me is that Shapley discussed how basically a sleight of hand had been created by the Biden White House, in that there were multiple jurisdictions that the serious stuff could have been charged in, and that the prosecutor, U.S. attorney in Delaware, who's a Trump appointee, a Republican.
In fact, I believe that's his name in AP style is Trump appointee. Yes. David Weiss. That is how he is referred to officially.
But according to Shapley, what essentially happened was the actual serious charges that could have been brought against Hunter Biden in California and in Washington, D.C. and potentially New York, that was something that the feds stepped in on and went, no, we're not going to be pursuing this. Do not pursue this. And what they basically did was carve out the things they weren't worried about and went, yep, Delaware, you can handle that. And so it creates the illusion, according to Shapley, or at least that is my interpretation of what he said, that this is actually being a very objective process. That to me is very strange. I'll also add that both Shapley and Ziegler, from where I'm at, seem to have no incentive to do any of this other than they are actual federal employees who care about the objective process. I do not know Shapley's political background. I know that Ziegler is a Democrat and a gay man, for what it's worth. I see absolutely no benefit to him whatsoever to be whistleblowing in this. I would need to know more to really, really weigh in on the IRS side of it, because I don't know the ins and the outs of the IRS stuff. But I do want to talk about the artwork for a second, because that does sound highly suspicious. So to remind everybody, Hunter Biden, who I honestly do have a sweet spot for, because I think he's probably got demons that very few of us can truly understand, and I hope he comes out of them. Had decided a couple of years ago that what he would now do, rather than be paid a $1 million a month or whatever it was as a Burisma advisor, due to his expansive knowledge of the energy sector in Eastern Europe, would become a painter. And so he began painting, and he got a deal with a gallery in Soho, and started making paintings. Now, as a brand new painter, the cheapest of these paintings was $75,000. They went up to $500,000. And while I am told by several sympathetic articles that this is not abnormal within economically ludicrous world of high art, that it still has a lot of capacity for corruption to occur. Because if I am selling a product that has only subjective value and you can buy it from me for $500,000, there is a possibility of influence peddling which could occur. We do not have conclusive evidence of this, but there is circumstantial evidence of it, which raises a lot of questions. You brought up a moment ago, Justin, a lady named Elizabeth Hirsch-Naftali purchased one of his paintings. We don't know for how much, but again, the minimum price tag was $75,000, so a decent chunk. And at some point, she was appointed to what sounds to me like the shittiest runner-up to an ambassadorship you can possibly get. She's a commissioner on the member of the Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad, which makes no sense to me since it's literally not even in America why that's considered an American interest. But to her credit, she draws no salary from it. This sounds like access to cool cocktail parties in Europe is my guess. But it sure looks like the same kind of stuff that we routinely do in the United States, where bundlers, campaign bundlers of both parties raise a shit ton of money for the person running for president, and then they get an ambassadorship when they leave. It looks very much like that, except in this instance, it could have been a mechanism where she did it through the gallery and Hunter Biden. That gallery has said that they would, as has the White House, that there would be no possibility of influence peddling because Hunter Biden would not know the people that purchased his artwork or for how much. Of course, in another sympathetic article, the gallery owner mentioned how fun it would be for Hunter Biden, as he was planning to do, to be at the art show so he could meet his prospective buyers. So I find it interesting that everybody's claiming that there is a hard, opaque line between the buyers and the sellers, except at the cocktail party where they'll be looking at the art. But they won't. No one will possibly tell him, I'm planning to buy this. That will never occur. That to me is that would reach the level of court scrutiny, I think, in some relevant campaign finance cases, if somebody did that. That is the appearance of corruption, to use language of the court. If I were the gallery or the White House, what I would insist on is radical transparency with it. Just release everybody that's purchased it. They've had a total of 1.3 million sales. One buyer purchased one for $875,000. I would very much like to know.
Can I just do a reporter whispering?
Sure.
That's the way that you word a thing when you are sure it's that lady, but you don't have the proof to say it's that lady and you don't want to get sued by that lady. So you just loudly say that one person purchased things for $875,000 or whatever the exact number is. But that is, if I knew it, but I couldn't prove it, that is how I would write it. Or at least I didn't have proof for it. Let's get to Jen.
I'm not following this though. Like, what do we think the connection to the president is here? Like, even if Hunter Biden is getting a lot of
money.
The White House
He's the one appointing Naftali.
Yeah. The White House made the appointment.
Okay. So Jen, rather than me giving money to your campaign, I give money to your kid. And then as a thank you note, you get appointed to the illustrious Commission for the Preservation of American Heritage Abroad. The other thing worth, okay. What I would like to know is if there's a bunch of very eclectic art dealers who are purchasing this because this is an interesting point of history, that would allay many of my concerns. But if the people that are making these 1.3 total sales are all Democratic political operatives who are otherwise not really invested in the art world, that, again, has the appearance of corruption. And I would like transparency in that matter. But at the moment, I don't know that there's anything that would be rock solid proof in terms of the corruption thing, unless they've got smoking guns going to Biden in terms of the artwork. However, I'd feel a lot better if they were transparent with the purchases. The IRS stuff, I think that there are some serious allegations that have been brought up by the whistleblowers, which seem credible to me.
Serious allegations, though, because I watched too much of the hearing. I made it until Marjorie Taylor Greene started waving dick pics around and then I couldn't take it anymore, but I still watched like 4 hours of it. Who exactly are you worried about? Like, from what you heard in the IRS hearing, because it feels like you and I watch two very different things. What exactly are you worried about in terms of President Biden from the IRS hearing?
So with the IRS hearing, I didn't watch the entire thing. You've got more information at your disposal than I have. I watched the testimony of Ziegler and I read the testimony of Shapley, both of whom strongly indicated that the prosecutorial recommendations of the IRS were snubbed. The venues through which prosecution could be executed were limited. And all of that was done by the Biden White House, and that it was extremely different and questionable compared to their all of similar investigations they'd participated in over 14 years. That there seemed to be a difference in terms of the execution of those cases, and that was highly, highly suspicious and indicated that there had been an attempt to shield the president's son.
Okay, that makes sense to me. The question and answer portion of the hearing actually shed some light on that in some important ways. So one of the things that I found very compelling is that a lot of the investigation that was done before President Biden was the president. A lot of this went down during the Trump years. And therefore, I don't know how President Biden could possibly abuse power that he did not have as a private citizen. So that timeline was very interesting to me. And my perception of these two dudes, having heard them both speak, I mean, first of all, I just got to tell you the ego on these two, especially the Ziegler guy, because the first half of his opening statement was like, don't call me a hero. And then he like thanked a bunch of people like he just won an Academy Award. And then he got into his testimony. And the other guy wasn't quite as bad, but he again was like, I'm just a regular citizen. Like, I'm not heroic. And it's like, yeah, no one's calling you a hero. And throughout the entire hearing, I just heard that
someone doesn't listen to One America News Network.
No, she doesn't. I heard two men with outsized egos who wanted to throw the book at Hunter Biden and wanted to get a lot of information on him. And they were told by their superiors, no, they were told you cannot have the laptop. You cannot interview the Biden's kids. You cannot raid the president's house. They were told no. And then when the prosecutorial discretion that they didn't agree with. They didn't agree with the charges. This apparently happens all the time, especially when the, you know, the taxes that weren't paid are paid in full. So getting a lesser plea agreement, this is not something that's unusual. And these guys didn't agree with it. And my main problem with them is they were arguing two opposite things. So on the one hand, they were arguing that we have this overwhelming evidence and they should throw the book at Hunter Biden because we have so much on him. There's all these felonies and it's fucked up that this guy didn't, you know, go forward with these felony charges. While on the other hand, they're arguing that they didn't have enough evidence and that's why they need the laptop and have to do the interviews of Joe Biden's grandkids and raid Joe Biden's house. You kind of have to pick one or the other. You either have overwhelming evidence or you didn't have enough. And these guys were arguing both sides the entire time. So I
don't know that those are mutually exclusive though, because you could have sufficient evidence and still say we would like additional evidence. You could say there's enough to be fishy, but there's this other stuff we weren't able to see.
I think also
it's evidence of what? Is this a tax dodging investigation or is this an investigation into, you know, Joe Biden and his business ties into Ukraine? So it's like their requests were going beyond what they needed to prove the tax dodging.
Do you believe that they were politically motivated, Jen?
I can't speak to why they do what they do. So that's not a question I'm comfortable with answering.
Because that is something that most of what you were saying was giving voice to a lot of what the Democrats were saying on, in the question and answer portion that I followed, specifically Jamie Raskin. The Democratic argument is what you laid out, that this happens all the time. Investigators disagree with what charges are brought because eventually it has to go to attorneys who are going to fight about what can and cannot be proven in a court of law. And often that differs from what investigators believe that they can prove.
Yeah. And one thing where the IRS investigators did have a point in that by not charging soon enough, Hunter Biden did get away with tax dodging that went down in 2014 in relation to his Burisma charges, which he said was a loan, but the people that it was basically funneled through, they claimed it as a business expense. Therefore, it was a payment. And because the statute of limitations ran out, he was basically allowed to keep that money. And so the investigators were pissed about that. But again, that I don't see how that has anything to do with President Biden. Like, that's, I just never saw the connection to President Biden.
Their point is that this was slow walked to the point where that was allowed to expire and that the pressure to do that came from somewhere above. I will correct Heaton. I do not believe that, at least in what I saw, they made a direct linkage to the Biden White House. They say, we don't know who was making these decisions. But somebody was making.
They also clarified that they don't know that Merrick Garland was lying. Shapley clarified that. He was very clear on that, that he, while he thought that Merrick Garland was wrong, he didn't know that it was a willful lie on the part of Merrick Garland.
Because both Weiss and Merrick Garland have said very clearly that the assertions that are made by both of these whistleblowers, that Weiss did not have full control over this investigation, that he, Merrick Garland has said that Weiss had the ability to go over the head of the attorney in DC and the attorneys in California. That is what the statement of the Department of Justice is. It is a direct contradiction from what the whistleblowers are saying, which is that at least for one of them, that they were in a room when Weiss said he did not have that authority. And so therefore there is a discrepancy between both the Trump appointed U.S. attorney, David Weiss, and Merrick Garland from what they have said on the record. Jen, I would say to your point of yes, a lot of this did happen under Donald Trump. What the whistleblowers are alleging is that they were ready with their investigation that they felt they had enough evidence on in 2021 after Joe Biden was the president. And that it was at that point that things not only gummed up, but also you had the allowance of the 2014 and 2015 tax crimes to expire on the statute of limitations, despite, according to one of the whistleblowers, that they had an agreement with Hunter's attorneys that they would allow that to be extended, and yet it was still allowed to expire. So that is their specific point to, it is after 2020 that they believe things were unreasonably slow walked.
And like, I think that still boils down to two men that felt disrespected in their job by their superiors, that felt that their opinions were not counting as much as they felt that they should be. Because in this entire hearing, I was hearing that prosecutors made decisions that they didn't agree with. I didn't see the tie to President Biden. I didn't see where this scandal hits the president ordering a slow walk. I don't see it. And that's really it. I didn't see it.
Well, I don't know that a miscarriage of justice in this instance has to implicate the president. It might. I'd be very, very surprised if there were any actual smoking gun which did so. But I think the thing that is disconcerting in this case is that if you were a part of a particular family, you might get kids' gloves. Not that, or I should say, in addition to the possibility that the president himself is calling up people and saying that, I don't know that that's the case either. I think like the timeline elements are important depending on what we're discussing, right? So like we've previously discussed the Burisma stuff. If I've got my timeline correct on this, when all of that was going down, Trump was in office Biden was no longer vice president. So the concerns
Obama
that,
was in office. This was all 2014, 2015.
Forgive me. There's a certain, I think the email of like the money for the big guy, whenever that one was, occurred when Biden was out of office. And so there are elements that are like relevant to the timeline. But with Hunter Biden in this, I could see a scenario where even if Biden was out of office and he wasn't the president, Hunter Biden is still shielded because he's one of our guys in the same way that the Bush family or the Kennedy family or something like that is. And so if there are elements within the justice system that are looking to keep somebody from getting embarrassed or cause distress, and as a result, they're treating somebody differently, that is relevant, even if the president is not directing it.
Well, and so I think what's happening here is that two different issues are getting conflated, because there's a tax dodging investigation, and then there's very legitimate concerns about the Biden family, and especially what went on in Ukraine during both, you know, when he was vice president and after. And it's Joe Biden himself who has raised some of these concerns by, you know, saying he had undue influence on prosecutorial decisions within Ukraine. And it is weird that Hunter Biden got that job with Burisma, and like that is a separate investigation. And I think these IRS whistleblowers were really curious about that stuff, as we all are. And so when I look at, you know, why should the American people care what the president's crackhead son does? I do think that is where the serious inquiry lies. But this is not the forum for that. The IRS is not the forum for that. And that is why this news that we're getting today out of this hearing, and I'm really curious to learn more about it after we hang up here, that there is an open investigation of Hunter Biden in relation to the Foreign Agent Registration Act. Like, That's the proper forum for that. That's where we're going to get the answers to these questions that I think we're kind of more interested in, but they are two separate things.
Well, not if they're saying that there were tax implications to the payments from Burisma in 2014 and 2015, and they're saying that they were not allowed to prove that that was the case because people above their heads did not, that they allowed those charges to expire, that they say it was a deliberate decision to let them expire.
Well, I mean, this Stormy Daniels shit with Trump goes back to 2016 and we're just getting an indictment in 2023. Like, justice moves slowly, and maybe we shouldn't have statute of limitations on shit like that, because if that is connected to this FARA investigation, you can't really settle that stuff. Like, this is exactly what we're hearing with the plea deal. If you're settling the tax issues before the statute of limitations, it could screw with the other investigation. So maybe the decision was made to kind of like put the tax stuff aside because the bigger fish is in the our investigation. Like, we don't know why that decision was made. And at this point, with that being an open investigation, they can't tell us. So that's why, like, I'm not terribly worried about that. And also the details about the 2014 stuff, Hunter Biden put it down that he got a loan. He wasn't hiding that he had a business deal with Burisma, but he said it was a loan. Then it was reported by someone else that it was a payment. Like, I think that where there are parallel investigations going on, we don't have the information at this point to be like, oh, Biden must have stepped in and told them to slow roll it. Like, this could actually lead to a much bigger problem for not just Hunter Biden, but Joe Biden, because that tax thing wasn't settled and it left the FARA investigation untouched. We don't know.
You're right. Can you understand the suspicion that it will just end quietly and no one will ever talk about it again? And the talking point will be it's settled.
I mean, I can understand being suspicious of a lot of things, but I like to see what the facts are. And right now at this juncture, we don't have them. So we have to use what we have. And when it comes to the tax stuff, from what I heard from the whistleblowers, I didn't hear any connection to Joe Biden that could be proven. And that was what we were asked to study
today.
Yeah,
exactly. No. The question was whether or not it rose to the level of suspicion rose to Joe. And I would say that for me, suspicion rises to Joe. I don't know if there is anything provable that rises to the level of Joe Biden, but I have had an askance look toward Hunter Biden for a while now and his protection from his father. I do think that there is a lot of smoke here, and we have spent a lot of time in this country talking about how precious whistleblowers are and how facts are facts and laws are laws. And that is something that I am curious. I'm curious by way of the discussion around this, exactly how much people actually care about that.
So on the whistleblower thing, I will acknowledge my command of the facts in this case, or with IRS Ricket Araka in general, I'm going to do like a 3 out of 10. This is not something that I feel super confident in my knowledge base on, but I will say from a broader systemic level, if someone were going to go, what are you looking for in a whistleblower? I would say somebody who's doing something that is not going to personally benefit them, that is probably going to be the detriment of their career and is potentially against their party. Like, it's hitting all of the marks for me of what a legit whistleblower would look like. I too, like Jen, cannot peer into their heart. I do not know if they're disgruntled egotists, which is compelling them, but the situation is enough to command my attention.
Well, I mean, it was clear because they said it over and over again that they didn't agree with the decisions of their superior. So I don't think that's peering into their heart. They said it.
Yeah.
And even if their intentions are the best, I just don't think what they were whistleblowing about was worth the risk, I guess. Like, I mean, I think they believe they're doing the right thing, because they said that too, but I wasn't compelled by the information they had to bring that it touched the president. Cause like, I don't know. I have a lot of empathy for Hunter Biden and for all children of powerful people, because they did not choose this. And so Hunter Biden is someone who's lost his brother. He has been in the spotlight. He never chose that. He has all these problems. He has his dick pics being floated around in Congress. I mean, it's so awful. I put myself in his shoes and it's all so awful. And I remember going back to the Clinton years when everyone in elementary school was saying that Chelsea Clinton was ugly. And I'm like, oh my God, like, this is horrible. I feel terrible for these kids. And so when they get different treatment, sometimes when it's in their favor, I don't get that upset about it, I guess, because they get all the negative shit that they never asked for. They never signed up for it. Like, Hunter Biden's not trying to get a position of power. He's definitely trading off of his dad's name. But does that lead to his father then being corrupt because he did it? Like, for me, Joe Biden is the one in power. Joe Biden is the one that we've trusted with that power. The connection has to be very clear for me to blame the father for the sins of the son. And I don't see that proof there in this hearing.
You said that you feel great sympathy for the children of people in power. I agree. It's not so much that I'm sympathetic to him as an addict. That said, I want you to clarify and expound upon when you said you're not that bothered by them getting a kinder treatment or an easier treatment or something like that. Are you implying that you're okay with there being different treatments for people, like in terms of the judicial system?
I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that this case is that. So there's that. Like, the fact that he paid his back taxes and other people have not, like, ideologically, I don't feel like people should be thrown in cages for failing to pay taxes, especially when they pay those taxes. So when I look at this and I'm like, oh, he's not spending time in prison, like, that kind of works for me regardless of who he is. But I also didn't get that crazy about, you know, Ivanka getting trademarks for her fashion shit in China. I didn't go that crazy about Jared Kushner getting deals with the Saudis. I mean, connections leads to this stuff. It just is how the world works. When it comes to the children, you know, you get dealt a tough hand by being the children of these powerful people, and there's advantages to it. And so I just, unless it leads to the person that we have trusted with power abusing that power for their children in some way, and I understand that there's possibilities in that in this case, which is what I think the foreign agent, you know, the FARA case could lead to. But until I see the actual person that we trusted with power abusing that power in some way, like, I just don't get this that crazy about it. And so, yeah, if Hunter Biden gets a slightly lower sentence while going, I mean, he dodged his taxes. Does he deserve this level of humiliation and this level of scrutiny from this many congressional hearings? And it's a lot on this guy. It's a lot. And so if he got a lighter sentence for his tax dodging, is this something that I'm going to be screaming about? No, I'm just not.
So you understand that some of those benefits extend to the justice system, and that is something that you are sympathetic to.
Yeah. And if anything, I just feel like those kid gloves should be applied more broadly, I guess. If people miss paying their taxes, I mean, because the thing is, too, he was filing his taxes. He just wasn't paying them. So it's like he's paying the bill late. Like, I don't know. The stuff about Ukraine, the foreign agent stuff, like, that is a level of seriousness to me that is far above this tax shit. So,
I agree with you, for the record. I mean, in the foreign agent stuff, I don't agree with you about the Justice Department stuff.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that they should give him a lighter deal, but I don't know that they did.
The question was hypothetical and not specific to this, but I would go the other way on that.
I think where sympathy comes into it is in sentencing, not in conviction. I don't think we should be treating people differently in terms of prosecution or conviction based on whether we like them or not or feel sorry for them. I think the sentencing is where that takes place.
I never said that. Okay. That's what I think.
I'm glad we clarified. It sounded to me like you were saying that perhaps we should go easier on certain people if we still feel sorry for them. But you're referring to that as the sentencing.
No, I'm saying, so I don't think that should be in the rule book, that the children of powerful people get a lighter sentence. Like, that is not what I'm saying. But when it happens, looking at it case by case, especially this particular case, the punishment should fit the crime. And this punishment with this level of public scrutiny, like, I think he's paying a price. I think the punishment with all of the public scrutiny being a part of that, I think he's paying enough of a price for this. It's just, it's a lot.
I would not trade places with Hunter Biden at any point in his life. I think he's got a really raw deal. That said, I am curious as to what you think about the art gallery, because that does seem to me to certainly have the capacity for a quid pro quo. There's no smoking gun, but there is circumstantial evidence. What do you make of that?
I'd like to know more about it. I would like to know Joe Biden's relationship with this woman. Is this someone that he's known for 30 years and she's a family friend and that's why she's buying Hunter's art? Or was it she's a stranger and she's buying the art and that had something like there's so much we don't know.
She is a Democratic donor. Based on insiders reporting, she is a Democratic donor that lives in the around the same area of LA that Hunter lives.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, the art dealer world in general is just a funnel for money laundering for rich people. I mean, that's what it is.
So wait, so that shouldn't be suspicious if it's happening around the White House?
That's not what I said. I said, I just don't know enough. I don't like pontificating about a situation where I fucking know nothing. So I don't know. Like if there's an investigation into that, I welcome it. But at the same time, like the investigation should be, is the president of the United States doing something shady? I just feel like this piling on of his son. I don't know. Unless
I will say I am extraordinarily sympathetic to the idea of addiction. Addiction has ravaged my family. It fundamentally ended my relationship with my father at a very young age. So I understand that addicts make horrifying decisions and oftentimes getting to repeating cycles for which they damage their lives and their relationships with their families, oftentimes irreparably. And having been somebody that has been through the 12-step cycle with a few different people, one of those steps is atonement for your crimes and owning up to it. And while I can be sympathetic to the hard road that Hunter Biden has had to walk, and one of the things that you left off, Jen, is the fact that his mom died and he was in the car when it happened.
Yeah.
That is a cycle of tragedy that man has been through. And he has made a lot of problems for himself, up to and including the things that happened now. That gun charge came because he implicated himself in his own book. The stuff, the problems for which he has made for himself cannot be excused by his addiction. Now, as to where we are at this case currently, I agree with you, Jen. There is no smoking gun here, but it sounds like based on what you are saying, I found the testimony of the whistleblowers to be credible on a level that did not impress you.
I mean, it can be credible that they were unhappy with their superior's decision and that they think something could be there, but unless there's some proof that someone in the Biden administration ordered any of it, which there was none, I just don't see it. And as for Hunter Biden, isn't pleading guilty a level of making amends? It's not like he's saying he's not guilty and then got this sentence. Like he pled guilty.
Well, he is attempting as we speak to plead guilty. We will find out exactly how that ends up depending on where it is. I will say though, we would not know that there was any conflict if it were not for them. That's the other thing. It's like, I do want them to come forward if they believe that the investigation was tampered with. We can agree with it or not agree with it. And then on a second level, we can say, okay, you brought X amount of evidence, but you did not bring Y amount of evidence, but I'm happy that they brought X. I'm happy that it's out there. I'm happy that we know that they believe these things happened. And
we have the X. I think we need to see the Y.
Sure. I would love to see the Y, but we wouldn't know that X existed if they did not come out. And I think to immediately move the goalpost beyond it instead of understanding what was said with X is one thing. I'm not saying that you're doing that, but it was part of the reason why I found the question and answer portion of that hearing so frustrating, because the Democrats were entire hand wave water carrying for Joe Biden and whataboutting into Trump as fast as they possibly could. And the Republicans were the Republicans. And, you know, you have Marjorie Taylor Greene showing censored dick pics, which is certainly an erosion of norms, as we talked about last week on the House floor. But I don't know how that is supposed to be processed through the idea that Hunter Biden uploaded so much of his own pornography to Pornhub that he got an award for it. Like that is that we have to understand that this is a very unique situation. He recorded himself fucking a lot and was putting it in the public sphere a lot.
I know. He's a problematic child.
if those two guys, if they are doing this whistleblowing because they feel snubbed and their egos have been bruised, they're making the dumbest career decisions of their entire lives. I can't think of a stupider thing for them to do if it's merely ego. I do want to finish up on the art thing. I don't actually have a problem with Hunter Biden and the art gallery. I think it's entirely possible that Hunter Biden is trying to find some peace in this world and just decided I'll become an artist and is hoping that he will somehow be left alone on this. But
that's what George W. is doing with those weird pictures of his feet.
Is he selling them?
I think so. I don't know. We should look into that.
I think it's entirely possible Hunter Biden was just trying to find something to do with himself. The issue with that is not Hunter Biden. I don't think that he's really being implicated in wrongdoing for anybody. The implication there is that is quid quo pro with Joe Biden, that there are people that are figuring out a way to pay him in kind through his son and they're getting rewards. It wouldn't surprise me at all if that's the case because the presidency is corrupt. It's been corrupt for all the presidents of my lifetime. And I say that with complete certainty based on how we apportion ambassadorships in this country. And I actually haven't checked on Biden's ambassadors. I would be amazed if it didn't include several political appointees who have no business being in the State Department, but gave him a bunch of money. I would be amazed and thrilled if that were the case. The ambassador to the United Kingdom under Trump was a baseball owner. That's it. Baseball team owner. Obama's ambassador to France, I think, was a soap opera producer. His ambassador to Hungary was some other Hollywood thing. These happen regularly. For some reason, we've exempted that from corruption. So it would not surprise me at all if that form of corruption were just manifesting in other ways. This seems like the exact same kind of thing. And I would be for, again, radical transparency, prosecuting where we can and changing how we do it with ambassadorships. Like it would literally, I'm not advocating this. It would literally be less, it would be more ethical at this point if we just had bidding wars for ambassadorships in this country. That would be more ethical than the current system because at least that money would go to the state.
you don't know that we don't. We just don't see it publicly. when they are lining up at that donor's dinner, we don't know that there's not just an open auctioneer of saying like, and now France, do I hear $100,000?
Yeah, but if it were open, that money could at least go to the state or a charity or taxpayers, as opposed to now where it goes to campaign coffers.
Yeah, but how else are advisors going to get paid?
It sounds like we need a systemic change when it comes to ambassadorships, but we need a lot more to prove that connection that you're suspicious of, because I don't think we have proof of it. I mean, you're talking to someone here who just went on this crazy rant about Donald Trump, and yet when I watched the impeachments, I said I would have been acquitted him both times. I think proof is important when you're going to hold someone accountable, and we don't have it in either of these cases. So
no, we don't, which is why, like, I think the House would be right to subpoena that art gallery. I think there is clearly smoke there. There is opportunity, opacity, and the appearance of corruption. And for that reason, I would encourage the House to look into it, because if it turns out that, you know, the day after this lady spent $870,000, if that is the case, on Nouveau art, and she doesn't regularly collect art, and then she got appointed to this bullshit commission, yeah, that would be sufficient circumstantial evidence. I doubt it's that clean cut, but I think that this is worth bringing into public scrutiny.
For the record, George W. Bush did sell his paintings at auction, but that appears to be after he had left the White House.
Yeah.
You know what would make a great art gallery is just art from old politicians.
Yeah, no word on if the twins were flipping art while George W. Bush was in the White House. The one thing here, and we'll get out on this, Jen, the one thing that I could imagine is frustrating to you is the fact that you have been so entirely frustrated and flummoxed by the House leadership of the Republican caucus here. I have joked on my podcast that, you know, when all you have is a hammer, everything is Hunter Biden for the House Republicans. And I think we would both agree that we would like more information, not less, when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Yes, but also there's limited time for investigations in Congress. And this particular committee is the one that's being chaired by James Comer. It's the one that used to be chaired by Carolyn Maloney. In the last Congress, there were investigations that were consumer protection investigations that I thought were so important. Like the ones with the, there were these beds for babies that were inclined too much. Yeah. And like they got those taken off the shelves. They saved lives with that investigation. And then an investigation that James Comer killed is into the Floresta flea and tick collars, which I had on my little Abby pup here for a little while. There's a combination of two safe poisons that apparently when you put them together, they're not safe. And the Republicans, they just stopped that investigation. So when I see, you know, like what affects my life? Does any of this affect my life? Anything related to Hunter Biden, even this, you know, art gallery stuff and the ambassadorships, do I really give a shit who the ambassador to France is? I really don't. But do I care if the product that I'm putting around my dog's neck could kill her? Yeah. So it's like there's things in this country that I just find far more important to our day-to-day lives than this. And if we're just going to have one investigation after another into this one man who happens to be the son of the president with a lot of problems and like, you know, there's issues there, but are they more important than the investigations that this committee used to do? I don't think so, because those were literally life-saving investigations and they're dead now. So that's part of my frustration as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the seesawing back and forth of investigating the president when the opposition party runs the House is something that is interesting. Interesting. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. This week, we're going to be talking about the actors strike, the actors and writers strike, and some of what, don't worry, it's not about AI this time. We've talked about AI and pornography enough on the Patreon. Jen wanted to talk about residuals. And so we are going to talk about that, the way that people get paid you know, for their art.
The reason that I picked that, did you see that Spotify is raising their prices?
Yes, they, yeah, so, and their stock took a little tumble.
Yeah. So they're raising their prices on me because I pay for two accounts, one for myself and one for my sister. And yet they're airing both of my podcasts and have paid me $0 for that. So it's just, There was some bitterness there and it just got me thinking on this whole like meta thing of how should we be paid for all of this? And like, yeah. So
spoiler alert, we don't get residuals and we never will, but you, the listeners can keep us in business. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. You get that bonus episode. Our extra topic comes out the same time as this episode. The show doesn't end for you. No. We keep rolling along. Okay. Now that we're done talking about hookers, crack and Hunter Biden, let me crack open a cold Anchor Steam. No reaction at all in an audio medium. Jesus fucking nice. Christ.
So it's where did you were able to get that? Where'd you get it from? I've never seen that beer before.
I went to Central Market yesterday as we had decided that we're going to talk about this story. And they had a big end cap that was Anchors Away. Go ahead and get your Anchor Steam now, because San Francisco's iconic Anchor Brewing Company, with a legacy stretching back 127 years, is on the brink of shutting down due to challenging economic conditions. The brewery, which announced its closure earlier in July, has until the end of the month before it liquidates, leading to an outpour of support from the community. In a letter channeled through their union, Warehouse Union Local 6, the employees expressed their intent to Anchor's parent company, the Japanese Sapporo. Anchor Brewing, the union wanted to purchase and operate the brewery as a worker co-op. Company has stated that they are open to the proposal, provided that it's legally binding and demonstrates a verifiable source of funds. The worker co-op idea has not only garnered immense support from Anchor Brewing employees, with around 40 of them actively participating, but also the community. Anchor Brewing workers, many of whom have deep roots in San Francisco, believe that the brewery's storied legacy should be preserved and run by the community. They've sought the support of Project Equity, an organizer familiar with worker co-ops, and have urged the company to give them sufficient time to put their plan into action. While the future of the brewery remains uncertain, the overwhelming community response and employee determination offer an amber beacon of hope for Anchor Steam. Jen, how should this be handled?
I mean, if the workers really want to own that place, they can go ahead. And I wish them well in that. I generally like worker co-ops, but the reality is that we have more breweries than we need. So I found a handy dandy chart here that shows that when the three of us were born in the 1980s, there were very few breweries. By the time we graduated college in the early 2000s, there were between 1,500 and 2,000 breweries. And as of last year, there were 9,709 breweries in the United States. It just skyrocketed between 2000 or around 2010 is when the skyrocketing started. And, you know, at least for the wine sniffers, like when they go out to do their wine tasting, they're out in nature and these beautiful hills and it's a whole experience. But all of these breweries I have found are like, come into my warehouse and like, oh, isn't it cute that the chair is an overturned bucket and we're going to feed you food out of a truck. Oh, and by the way, here is your half a beer for $14.
And also the beer is going to be the hoppiest goddamn beer you've ever had.
Fuck yeah.
It's craft beer. So it's going to be nothing but hops.
Love
it's
it.
Be 3/4 hops.
You're right. USA, USA. You've described my perfect world. Yes, of course. 9,000 rookie numbers. We need more. We need more. Okay. We need 18,000. We need constant expansion of breweries like the universe itself.
Well, unfortunately, the market, as Anchor Steam is finding out, doesn't agree with you. At a certain point, the overturned bucket chairs and the food trucks in the warehouse, it's stopped being cute. And I don't think that the market's going to sustain this level of breweries. I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area for a long time with a lot of beer snobs and they dragged me to all these goddamn breweries. We never went to Anchor Steam because it's not easy to get to. You have to drive there pretty much because it's not easy to get to from BART. I think the market is saying bye-bye. Because like even when we would drink local beers, we were always getting Lagunitas or Faction, but like Anchor Steam wasn't even in the conversation. So I'm just seeing these workers wanting to save the place that they love. And I get it. But if the market's saying that we don't want it, maybe don't invest your life savings in that.
Anchor Steam may or may not be a regional beer. And what Sapporo purchased may not be something for which has exported beyond San Francisco. But I do think that it would be let's clear up. Anchor Steam is not, you know, like 21st Amendment or any of the other more recent craft breweries that have come to San Francisco. They are a very old company and they do a less popular style of beer. They do a Pilsner where I know.
I love Pilsner.
There we go.
It's my preferred kind. I don't like IPA.
IPAs are more, like are more popular.
And yet how many times have you had an Anchor Steam, Andrew?
Well, now that they're unionizing and purchasing it as a man of the people, I will support the proletariat beer, Jen.
I mean, I'm drinking it.
Which actually is why I think they might be okay for that reason. I don't disagree with your macroeconomic analysis that there are a fuck ton of breweries. I think that that's accurate. By the way, hats off to the great Jimmy Carter who made all of that possible. Jimmy Carter, one of the finest presidents in terms of deregulation. Yeah, no, because it was beer was strictly regulated at a federal level throughout the United States. It's when Jimmy Carter lifted those regulations that craft breweries started. There were like 9 in the country, I think, as you said, in 1980. Like, yeah, that's Jimmy Carter. Like, yay, Jimmy Carter. He was the one that allowed that to be possible. And now we're getting the world that Justin wants to live in. Mm-hmm.
I do. I enjoy living in it.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. To your point, Jen, I think you're probably right. There's too many of them. That said, though, they do have an angle, which is if the union purchases the brewery and they have a workers co-op, I know a bunch of people that would buy a workers co-op beer if they could just get the marketing to them and say, you know, this is owned by the workers. It's for the workers, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's an angle there. Mm-hmm. And I would applaud that and wish them luck on it. I think co-ops are a great idea. While I tend to be the reflexive free enterprise guy, and I suppose I am on this podcast. What really is at root is just people being able to pursue their own agendas and organize however they like. That's what I'm in favor of. And so if a group of workers want to do that, that's awesome. More hats to them. I worked at a co-op when I lived in England, and I have to say it was great from an employee perspective because they weren't trying to do big profits. It was worker owned. I will say it was kind of inefficient. I don't know how much I would have enjoyed it as a customer, but it seems to be fine. They do groceries and other things in England, and I worked there. It was terrific. I wish there was more of this kind of thing. I think that the kind of, yay workers own the means of production stuff, that the problem that I have with that is when somebody steps in and goes, and we should force everybody else to pay for it. That's when I start having the issue. But if people just want to unionize, buy it and have it run by the workers, I think that's terrific. And the economy's big enough, we could have lots of things like that. I wish this would flower more. I wish there were more housing communes. I wish there were more housing options for people where you can go live in a dorm with a bunch of folks and have that be a collective entity.
I'm going to go even further. I believe that the state of California should buy Anchor Steam.
God damn it.
I believe.
That's what I just fucking said I'm against.
I believe. I know. And I'm going further. I'm going further than you. I'm going to say, whatever the state version of nationalize, the amount of dumb money that is spent in California on stuff that is absolutely just giving it to thieves. Like, let's just even look at the amount of cash that is put into programs that is known to be graft by people who steal it from the state. The investment that would be put into purchasing and then turning over to these union workers to just make a thing that brings some level of pride to San Francisco, which I don't know if y'all paid attention to the news lately, is not exactly at a high state of things are going great right now. An icon, Anchor Steam beer is iconic in San Francisco. Like that is a thing for which you should know when you go to a random bar. There are a few taps for which you will see at all of them. Racer 5 is one of them on the IPA. Lagunitas is one of them on the IPA. And Anchor Steam is one of them. From a liquor perspective, you'll see Fernet Branca in San Francisco more than like anywhere other than like the one place in Italy that it's made. I think that it is. Culture is important. And Gavin Newsom, I'm calling on you. Purchase Anchor Steam from Sapporo.
Andrew, bite his head off.
This is one of the things I love about Justin's analysis. Justin, you were the most clear-eyed realist among us. I think Jen and I are idealists. We have an idea of how the system ought to work. We differ in how it ought to work, but we do have systems in mind that we want. I think you see through the neoliberal and pinko colored glasses. You see through them. You take them off and you see the gritty, corpulent gears of government, and you say, I just want the graft to work well.
Yeah.
You want to prioritize the better graft over the inferior. I want to get rid of the graft. Jen, I assume, wants to get rid of the graft. You're like, nope, graft's always going to be here. We're always going to have pus. Let's try to put the pus where we want it and have the graft of the good stuff.
Yeah.
And just have this very, very cynical system based on realism. You're probably right. You haven't swayed me to your position, but in the end,
because it would be a one-time thing. If you're just, all right, whatever, check to Sapporo. I mean, yeah, you're right. At that point, I'm sure all of Gavin's wineries would be purchased up by the state. So I'm probably setting a terrible precedent. But and my tongue is a little bit in cheek on this one. Maybe it's the Anchor Steam that's talking to me. But like, I think it's a bummer. I do think, Jen, I agree with your point more that there is an element of beer economics. People are drinking less beer in America. They are drinking less in general, and they are drinking less beer specifically. There was a reason, I forget which Super Bowl it was. I think it was like two or three Super Bowls ago, but there was a great story that was reported on that there had been late stage negotiations amongst all the major breweries in America that they were going to do big Super Bowl ads that for the first time would be unified in a Got Milk style campaign to advance the idea of beer drinking, because they were looking at an industry-wide decline. And I think it might have been the Dilly Dilly ads where Bud Light was like attacking Coors and Miller Lite. Like it was like a Game of Thrones style. We are, you know, attacking these other breweries that made everything fall apart. But that is something that is real. People are drinking less. And so Sapporo, a foreign company that purchased an asset that they are not seeing pay off for them, I can understand why they would look at it and say, fuck it. Let's just liquidate it. Let's just get whatever we can for it. And they don't want the hassle of trying to sell it to somebody. They literally just want to declare whatever they can so they can be done with this property as soon as possible. And I think it matters to San Francisco. There's not a lot of things that matter to that large swath of people in one of America's most forward-facing cities. And I think it would be a bummer if it went away.
Justin, I'm going to join you tongue in cheek. I think you can make a good path for why this should be run by the state, not just purchased, but run by the state that I would like.
Yeah.
If this beer is purchased and administered by the state legislature of California, I think tasting the resulting concoction would be so good for Californian democracy, where people drink it and go, the fuck is it so full of lavender? Oh, well, because there's a big lavender donor. What about this other weird thing? Just straight up fucking incompetence. And which I think it could actually be a good wake up call.
So you would say you would be for it if the formula for it is passed and ratified through the California State House. If you
exactly.
took
every year,
every year, you submit the formula as it was. So it starts with the formula that's been around for 127 years. It mm-hmm. starts with that formula. And then you mm-hmm. let all of the different amendments and the donors yep. who are like, no, you got to buy California grain. Turns out they buy Idaho grain, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. I think that would be great. And you could put all on the can. The can would just be this massive label explaining how the fuck this horrible witch's brew came to be.
Well, congratulations. You've turned this into a Reason video. And I'm glad that you finally got here.
I'll call Austin immediately.
Jen, so Anchor Steam is not anything that you ever really cross paths with. You're not a Pilsner person.
No, I've actually drank it a few times, but it's not something that I reach out for, because I like Andrew, a very hoppy beer is revolting to me. And so I did like the Pilsner aspect of it, but
yeah,
no, and just the location of it alone, like it's a terrible location. You have to go to the 16th and Mission and like walk forever.
Oh, I don't think anybody goes to the brewery. I mean, I think people are going to the brewery now. No, but it's got distribution throughout the Bay Area. Like every bar that you go to has an Anchor Steam tap. Every supermarket you go to has Anchor Steam bottles. Like it is a regional beer.
It's a but that's an issue, right? Because like you and I in Austin have drank Lagunitas together. So it's
yes.
other beers that are Bay Area competitors have gone beyond the Bay Area. So it's like, if these unionized workers or whatever they're trying to be a co-op, if they want to buy it, I honestly wish them well. And like, I get what you're saying, that another historic thing in San Francisco going away would be really bad. Like San Francisco's having a bad time. So to lose Anchor Steam, it would be sad. But would I personally invest in this business? No, I just wouldn't. So I just don't think it's a good financial decision.
Can I say this?
All the rest of whoever, it aside.
Whoever controls Anchor Steam, either going forward or buys it out of bankruptcy, this can that I'm holding right now is stark yellow. It looks inspired by every fucking brewery, every fly-by-night brewery. It looks very inspired by Sierra Nevada. And their style guide. Bullshit. What's iconic about Anchor Steam is a brown bottle with a very specific old timey logo. Like the fact that it has gone to this bullshit design is reason for them having the kind of problems that they are having. That's an Anchor Steam. An Anchor Steam is in a brown bottle with that ship, that weird illustration ship logo on it. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Ugh. All right. Yeah,
that can is not appropriate.
No, I was like, I almost didn't buy it because I saw the can and I'm like, oh, no wonder why you're in this problem. This can sucks. This isn't Anchor. Also, it's in a can. I don't think I've ever drank Anchor Steam out of a can. I've always drank it out of a bottle.
Yeah.
But best I could get in Austin, where I fled because I didn't like the Bay Area. Let's go to our mailbag, wherenotwrongpod@gmail.com. Through the mist, you hear a foghorn and see in the distance, wherenotwrongpod@gmail.com. A moment of clarity writes, I disagree with you guys a lot, especially on foreign policy and intelligence issues. I'm biased. It's my profession. But I really appreciate you guys for a multitude of reasons. And I'll highlight one. You force me repeatedly to remember that just because I disagree with, sometimes vehemently, with someone doesn't make him a bad person. If I may pontificate for a moment, it's crucial training for being a citizen to our republic. You're building a little community of people who aren't reflexively tribalistic. And I do believe that through multiple small efforts such as this, that we can turn our national ship away from the rocks. So thank you guys for being willing to put yourselves out there and endure the inevitable slings and arrows.
I love that. Thank you so much for taking the time to write that. That's kind of exactly why we love doing this.
Yeah, it's a very nice. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
And now it's time for Heat and Sports Corner Topic of the Week!
Andrew, put that phone down.
Yep.
Heaton, I'm just making sure I got the name right.
Heaton, the Scottish player Stephen Hendry, won this world championship 7 times in the 1990s. Is he the GOAT?
Absolutely. Stephen Hendry is a national treasure. Hell of a boxer. I'll tell you this much. When I was a kid, my Uncle Frank and I met Stephen Hendry on a trip to Scotland, and he punched my Uncle Frank right in the face. And we were like, what happened? And then later that day, no more cancer. Stephen Hendry cured my uncle by punching him in the face. One of the greatest boxers who's ever lived. Scotland is a fine country.
You know, it's very, very interesting. I don't know if this is a terminology that you're so familiar with sports that I'm just not familiar with, but obviously a stroke was part of Hendry's game. And also, I'm pissed off that you're looking at your phone because I put Heaton, don't Google this. Your flummox surprise is the bit. So
I didn't Google it. I did see the question. Yeah. So when you say stroke, you're referring to the obvious golfing side game he did.
Let's just say he's potted a few pinks in his day.
Yeah, well, you know, I get it. I think Stephen Hendry's known on our side of the Atlantic primarily for golf, but over in Scotland, you know, boxing, he's
golf might be another term in this sport that is primarily played and televised over across the pond where you are right now, but you know,
was it tennis or what they call wicker golf?
He had their balls were involved, several of the same color. One of a different color.
My God, what a multi-talented man. He also played volleyball?
No, more of an indoor
croquet
sport.
Croquet has multiple balls.
No. A felt. He was a king of the felt.
Oh, was it snooker?
Of course it was. Whatever happened, writes, did we ever learn more from Congress about the Chinese balloon we shot down, Jen?
I'll take this one. Yes. In fact, I was working on an episode on this and then just stopped doing it. What we learned is that when the military found out about the balloon floating over, I think they discovered it over Montana. Mm-hmm. They took a bunch of steps to basically hide anything that could be collected. There was a lot of concern that the balloon was going over places where we stored nuclear weapons, stuff like that. And so the military took steps to hide things. And so even though they do seem to believe that there was spying equipment on there, they don't think that anything was collected. So there you go.
Joe Biden has said at donor events, he has insinuated that President Xi was upset about the process because he was not aware of the balloons. That is something that he said that wound up causing ripples in the diplomatic sphere. So that is not anything that was heard through congressional testimony. Something that he said out loud. The party that cried wolf writes, unfortunately, the Democrats shot their wad too early and played a hand they didn't have and generally fucked us all by being so loud. And as we are recently finding out, so wrong about Russiagate for years. So when it turns out that Justin is right about every new indictment serving to strengthen Trump's campaign, we can thank the ones so desperate to get him out that they couldn't keep it in their pants for a few years.
God, I agree with that. I just did my, recorded the episode about Adam Schiff, about the censure of Adam Schiff. And so I had to revisit a lot of that stuff with the impeachments. And I got angry all over again about how, especially the second one was botched. Like they rushed both of them. Neither of them had to be rushed the way they were, but that second one, like they didn't have the evidence before they impeached him. And because they botched it so horribly, Donald Trump is still able to be president. Like, I'm so angry at the Democrats. And so I definitely feel this email. It's infuriating.
Tax relief for public service rights. What about a civil hours requirement? Have individuals participate in at least 40 hours of civic engagement every year for a steeply lower tax rate. Increase the tax base rate to compensate. Voting would count as a certain number of hours, so would jury duty and serving in the reserves. The rest of the hours could be made up of volunteering at charities, not-for-profits, or giving lectures at a town hall or park.
I think that this is predicated on the idea that the American people are too selfish to be left on their own, and they need to be compelled to do things which are selfless or community-building, otherwise they will not do so. If you believe that, I think that trying to get them to elect people to force them to be good is not a winning proposition. If we're all kind of inherently selfish and we're not going to go do charity work, we're not going to care in our community, having all of us vote on somebody to enact a system to make us do it does not seem to me to logically follow. I would also add that while I like certain elements of what you're saying, and I totally get why you're saying it, because those things are important that you describe, I think you'd run into a can of worms very quickly. You mentioned in there that you could get credit for, say, doing charity work or something like that. I when I lived in Tulsa, every week went to a group that gave out hot dogs and hamburgers to homeless people, socks, things like that. While I am a chummy, low wattage agnostic, the group was a church. So would that qualify for that? I would think so. But at the same time, then you open up the door for like, well, if we do parochial activities for the Catholic charities, or we just go door knocking as Mormons, are they going to do it? Which means all of this is going to end up being submitted to the political process where everything we just described and this and every other program is now going to be in charge of allocating what is okay and not okay. To me, that doesn't make a lot of sense. What I would suggest is I think that in terms of some of the civic virtues you're mentioning, it's part of a broader conversation we can have of the fact that the 20th century spent so much time and effort trying to fetishize productive output, both from the state and from corporations. Kind of both governments and corporations are trying so hard to get people to do jobs because jobs were so important that we as a people, to a great extent, lost the appreciation for many of the valuable things that aren't jobs. And so if you wanted to have a government solution to this, as I think you do, I would hypothesize that a universal basic income would be a more effective way to do this, because then you'd be able to give people the material resources to pursue many of the things that you would like them to do, but it would be done for everybody and we wouldn't have to worry about chalking it up to the political process.
Yeah, I also don't love this suggestion. I think it would be more efficient to, well, first of all, spend our taxes wisely, but collect taxes, but have a government jobs program so that the people that want to basically coast, that aren't that ambitious and don't want to climb a corporate ladder or anything, we'll do the basic public services that aren't getting done. So I'm thinking off the top of my head, in the Bay Area, there's trash everywhere. You exit any freeway and there's just mountains of trash. We could pay people to pick it up for a living and use our taxes to do that, where I feel like volunteering, it's not really volunteering if you're doing it for a tax reduction. So why don't we just use the taxes and pay people to do the things we need them to do?
I will say that the biggest thing that offends me in this is the fascist attempt to erode our nation's citizen from their right to not vote. Not voting is something that should be enshrined and protected, and it is cool and legal.
Do you know what the Australians do, which I just found out and I find interesting?
I hate this, but go ahead, please. Yeah.
No. The Australians have compulsory voting.
You know that. Because they're slaves to the state.
Right. But hold on, though. They're not required to vote. They're required to send in a ballot.
Yes.
You don't actually have to mark a name down. You could say, I hate all these fuckers, and just give it back blank with your name on it. That's legal. So which I do find interesting. It does put kind of a spin on it where you're sort of required to do jury duty in effect, but you're not required to actually participate in the system.
No.
So there's a little bit more freedom than I thought.
Well, I mean, and then they try to sneak people in by feeding them sausages and stuff like that, which I find to be a gross way to pervert the electorate by way of encased meats. The job of a politician writes, a politician's job is not to write laws, nor is it to get elected. Their job is to represent the people in their district that voted for them, which is why I get so annoyed when people who say politicians should, quote, do their job and vote for the thing I care about, quote, even if it hurts their career, unquote, if an elected representative votes for a bill that they are not reelected because that vote is not a noble sacrifice for the good of the people, it's them failing at representing the will of their people. Politicians should absolutely be afraid of losing an election, because any politician who loses a reelection campaign is somebody who is so bad at their job that the people decided to hire someone else.
Nope. Disagree with that completely, because you are not elected to just represent your party. You are elected to represent the entire district. And sometimes what's good for the entire district, if not the entire country, is not something that your party is a fan of. I'm thinking specifically of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Both of them are no longer in Congress, but they did the right thing by participating in the January 6th committee.
She
and
didn't
doing
run
an
for re-election in a material
she did
way.
And she lost. But
no, she ran a national campaign. She ran a terrible campaign that should have lost.
Either way, I think they did the right thing. And in representing your entire district, sometimes your party is going to turn against you, which causes you to lose your election. Sometimes you know that's going to happen, but it's still the right thing to represent everyone and not just the people that voted for you.
Yes.
To clarify, is this person saying, I don't think the person's saying that you represent your party. I think they're just saying that it is their job to get elected, which is a proxy for the will of the people they represent.
Not necessarily, because getting elected a lot of times means doing the bidding of just your party, especially the way things are working now. So
if
there's
a heavy lean of that party to the people, but isn't that the will of the people?
No, I don't disagree that there's structural things. We talked about all that. I think the person saying that, like, the job of when I was in Congress, one of the things I was struck, or when I worked for Congress, one of the things I was struck by was not that the congressmen were like evil. It was that they were hyper parochial. Like, the way we've designed the system in this geographic based system is you represent a geographic unit. And so they would be, you know, emphatic about jobs in their district. But I get it. Like, their job was to get jobs to their district, even if it is aggregately not going to work out for the country. I don't like it. I'm just saying I see their point in the email.
Well, yeah, but I think this email is a reaction to what I said, because pretty sure he just quoted me. And I just feel like there are
Well, he also quoted me.
Okay.
He was saying fuck us both, but yeah.
Yeah. Which is like, you know, fine. That's your right.
That's good. But, yeah. It's good email.
But I just feel like there's two different jobs. There's getting elected. And then once you're elected, you have to represent everyone and not just those that elected you. It's an entire district. It's not just your party. We're getting elected a lot of times is directed at messaging to half, or as I think you pointed out, maybe a quarter of the people in your district, depending on who votes. But once you're in office, it is your job to represent everyone in that district. And sometimes that does not win you re-election. They're two different missions.
I would love it if we could count on all politicians to believe it is their sacred duty to do what is right, regardless of whether they get elected or not. That would be a wonderful place to live. I do not think I live there, but that would be nice.
Is Heaton Alive brings us on home. I am upset, outraged, and astonished. The fact that Andrew Heaton did not immediately start talking about zoning once Briney started talking about high housing costs, especially in a place like San Francisco, is a clear degradation of an intelligent, moral, and per his own words, well-hung Spock.
He was drunk.
Thank you.
He's 9 hours
Thank
ahead of us.
Much.
That's all.
Yeah, I think my position on zoning and housing is well established. And to my credit, there was a lot going on that time. Is this from last week when Jen, you were talking about how it's better to be poor in Mexico than in America? Like, there was a lot.
Yeah,
I guess. I don't know. I don't know which week is which.
I don't. Yeah. I mean, I would love to correct you on this, but I have no idea what happens on a daily basis when it comes. I talk for a living. So, you know, it is what it is.
I'm always happy to give a screed on the evils which overzoning has inflicted, not just on the American people and their God-given liberties, but in particular to the poor, trodden, and homeless who are further enfranchised by said tyranny.
Are you on Cameo, Heaton?
No.
You should make a Cameo account, and literally whenever you want to tell your friend a zoning take, you should pay Heaton $15 and he will record it into his phone and with your friend's name at the front, and he will go on and on and on about zoning as much as you want.
Yeah.
This sounds great.
Since you did bring up the poor in Mexico thing, I did have a conversation with my friend Gabriel here, who speaks perfect English. He works for the Hyatt. He worked in the United States for a long time, still has a work permit. So we were talking about how he needs to go back just to like renew that, but he wants to stay here. And I told him about our conversation and I asked him, where would you rather be poor? He said here in Mexico for similar reasons. He just feels like it's easier to get your basic needs.
A Mexican
needs.
National. Yes.
Yeah. He has the ability to go to the States. He's lived there for years. And it was interesting that he also said here.
He's from Mexico.
Okay. Saying like that was the answer.
But sure,
I remain largely agnostic on this. I know nothing about the Mexican social welfare system. I do know that their median wage is $1,600 a month. So it is a much smaller economy and the average person earns much less. But I don't need as much. That's the point. Because the economy is so much more sluggish. Like when economies don't work well, everything's cheaper.
Okay, that's not what's happening, but okay.
Wait, like, do you think the government is like making everything cheaper through fiat?
I don't think that quality of life is dependent upon how the overall economy is doing. I think that if you can earn, you know, $1,000 a month, but that gets you housing and healthcare and food and childcare, if you can get all those needs covered for less money, that's a higher quality of life than someone who is earning $4,000 a month and yet can't afford any of that shit. So I don't think, I think judging what quality of life is like for poor people in country to country, you can't just look at like the overall economy and say that's a wealthy economy or that's a shitty economy. You have to see like how well do you get your needs met.
100% I agree with you. However, I will gently posit as well that staying at a nice hotel in an affluent neighborhood of Mexico City would also be an anecdotal way to approach it. And neither of us really have the knowledge necessary to make this decision.
I was giving you an anecdote.
Case closed. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg, who's so tired because I think he had to wake up at like 1 o'clock in the morning to cover a Samsung press conference today. Jen, what's cooking on the dish?
So I don't know. I've already finished my Adam Schiff episode, but after we are done here, I'm diving down a UFO rabbit hole because as we speak, there is a UFO hearing where
UAPs.
Some of the... Whatever. They're fucking UFOs. I'm not switching it. We all say UFO. you know what I'm talking about. But I'm going to watch the hearing because I've already watched two other ones and neither of them were all that interesting, but I think the three together could be. And so if this one today is as interesting as I'm kind of suspecting it will be, I might have a UFO episode this weekend. If not, we get to analyze whether or not Adam Schiff should have been censured.
Gotcha. Heaton.
I bring on the guy with the most soothing voice who's ever been on the political orphanage in the last 4 years to talk about how bullshit statistics work. Both in terms of malfeasance, where the person making it is intentionally warping the data to trick you, and just well-intentioned incompetency. So if you've ever looked at a medical study and been like, I should never eat cherries again, or alternately, you've looked at some economic data and it clearly says this thing that they want you to think, I talked to a guy to help peer through some of that and give you the intellectual tools to not be hoodwinked. That is on the Political Orphanage this week.
Here we go. And on PX3, our Wednesday episode is all about why this Republican primary sucks. So if you are into that, I talked to Bill Scheer of Washington Monthly about our frustrations that there is very little narrative on the bone thus far. and whether or not we will see more going forward. And then on our Friday episode, I actually up Jen's alley have a reporter from The Hill who covers the Senate, so we can discuss the differences between Republican senators and Republican House members. And I'm going to do a deep dive into a interesting piece of radio history, Paul Harvey's If I Were the Devil monologue that has since been co-opted in more recent political relevancy. It was parodied in a Trump ad that was released over the last 24 hours. So we talk about that, a little piece of radio history. But if you've never heard the If I Were the Devil, it was initially performed on Paul Harvey's radio show in, I believe, 1965, and then was updated periodically, most notably in 1996 before he died. So go ahead and listen to PX3 for that. Till then, that's it for us. For Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, I'm Justin Robert Young, and we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.